Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Russia's military buildup along its border with Ukraine has the world on edge of a possible escalation of a conflict that has been taking place in the eastern Ukraine since 2014. With the drumbeat of war getting louder, it seems more of a case of when and not if an invasion and a full-scale invasion takes place. Joining The Crisis Next Door is Michael Kaufman, Director of Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analysis and a fellow at the Center for New American Security. Michael, thank you for joining The Crisis Next Door.
Yeah, thanks for having me on your program.
Michael, let's talk about the current buildup of Russian forces along its border with Ukraine. We've seen this ongoing. Where are we going to be as far as a tipping point is concerned when Russia is fully ready to attack Ukraine? We've seen field hospitals coming in. What is the next signal before we know that Russia is ready to go all in?
You know, unfortunately, the answer is it really depends on what they intend to do and their actual political objectives and supporting military plans. So it's fair to say at this stage that if Russia wanted to conduct a more limited military operation, it is in position to do that now, that is today. But my suspicion is that they have more maximalist aims and that if they intend a large-scale military operation, something that's previously not been seen in the past in Ukraine, then they are perhaps some weeks away from being in position to do that based on the pace of the current military buildup and the kind of capabilities and assets and forces that I think we're seeing them put into place. And keep in mind that my point of view comes from based on what we can see via open sources. And so you have to take that with two big grains of salt. The first is that using public sources, you definitely don't see everything, not at all. So a number of things might already be there. And second is that often what you see is delayed. That is, when you're assessing a buildup that you think might be heading towards a military operation in the coming weeks, you have to be frank with yourself and appreciate that, you know, you're seeing things in time lapse, right? And you might be late to judge certain capabilities arriving into the region, right? Not everything is visible at the same time. We're certainly not omniscient.
Russia obviously has several military options at its disposal here. What do you think are the most likely military options that Vladimir Putin and his generals are considering?
So I think that they're somewhat been trapped over the past years from using force to compel Ukraine towards sort of signing settlements, but not being able to actually enforce Russian preferences. That is, after several offensives, they still have been able to achieve political aims. That's why I fully believe that they're not going to repeat that which hasn't worked for Russia in the past. This is not going to be a limited military incursion designed to just compel Ukraine towards yet another political settlement to try to achieve Russian aims. I think the Russian objectives are going to be probably one of three scenarios, and of course they're going to stay emergent. It's very hard to, when you plan a military operation, to really see past the opening phases of it. But most likely, Moscow will either attempt to conduct regime change in Ukraine and most likely drive to encircle the capital, Kyiv, perhaps seize Ukraine's eastern regions, and then arrange a settlement whereby they tie withdrawal to implementation, basically try to achieve their aims this way. This involves Ukraine's regions east of the Dnieper River, a fairly sizable part of the country. Or if those don't work, a much more expensive and less likely option, but one that definitely remains on the table, is partitioning the country and essentially perhaps creating an alternate government and state that's pro-Russian in either Ukraine's eastern or even southern regions. And this I think is less likely, but should definitely not be discounted. There's strong evidence that Russian military plans include an occupation force. So they're clearly considering the possibility of having to occupy some territory for a period of time beyond even having follow-on forces backing their sort of offensive maneuver formations.
Russia obviously outnumbers the Ukrainian military by a sizable number and percentage. What kind of shape is the Ukrainian armed forces in order to provide some sort of effective defense against a potential Russian invasion? How long could they hold out for? I know that Western arms are making their way in, but is that going to be enough to give Ukraine some time to hold Russia at bay for some time?
You know, it's very hard to kind of war game out conflicts of this type. War is highly contingent. Depends on what the Russian military campaign actually is and how Ukrainians choose to respond to it. The biggest differences between these militaries are not so much quantitative, they're qualitative, right? The Russian ground forces are backed by one of the world's largest parks of fixed-wing tactical aviation, rotary aviation. They are much better equipped, better trained than the like. So the force multipliers really begin to stack. It's not a question of, you know, one side having 50,000 troops and the other side just having 100,000. And it's a quantitative asymmetry. The qualitative asymmetry is quite stark. Ukraine's military has gotten a lot better over the years in terms of tactical level capabilities, but it's structurally deficient in a number of important ways and fundamentally inexperienced with combined arms maneuver warfare at this higher level. As most of Ukraine's experience has been in kind of limited position warfare and skirmishes at the line of control in the Donbas. So I think it's fair to say that, well, the Ukrainian military is certainly large and capable enough to impose some cost of attrition on Russian forces, especially if the Russian scheme is actually a more kind of limited incursion, which I find deeply unlikely. It's not well positioned to defend what is first the largest country in Europe, and Ukraine geographically is the largest country in Europe, rest assured of that, against what is principally the largest military in Europe outside of, you know, the NATO alliance. So the matchup, all things being equal, is very much in Russia's favor, and Russia doesn't even need a superiority in numbers because it has substantial overmatch in terms of full force multipliers and what the Russian military can do as a force compared to the much more limited capabilities of the Ukrainian military. Instead, Ukrainian military definitely has options. It very much depends on how they choose to play it. That's a big question, the answer to which we do not know. They do have a number of combined arms maneuver brigades. They have artillery and support brigades. They have territorial brigades, essentially volunteers, that are kind of, you know, a reserve. It's definitely not the military 2014, 2015. So this would be, to some extent, a much bloodier fight. But in terms of the way they are positioned, Ukrainian military is deeply disadvantaged because Russian forces deployed in Belarus, northeast, east of Ukraine, and south of Crimea, ring Ukraine, essentially an envelopment. So if you picture a multi-axis attack, it could very easily split Ukrainian forces, envelop them, fragment them in individual pockets, and create big challenges for a much smaller military with much more limited capacity for maneuver and logistics to be able to defend this tremendously large space.
Michael, you mentioned the territorial brigades, and we've seen the reports of civilian mobilization in preparation for defense of Ukraine. Obviously, not the same as a well-equipped armed force going up against Russia, but how effective can a civilian mobilization be? And what does that at least tell you about the country's morale facing this potential invasion?
You know, Ukraine's response, to be honest, has been kind of schizophrenic because the political leadership is so frightened by the prospect of the threat of this invasion essentially killing the Ukrainian economy before Russia's, you know, even does anything militarily, right? Because if you look at Ukrainian bond spreads, foreign direct investment leaving, the need for Ukraine's central bank to prop up the currency, Ukraine's under heavy economic pressure. So the political leadership is trying to maintain calm while also making some preparations for defense. But guess what? You cannot prepare and mobilize people for defense of a nation while also say that the threat of invasion isn't really there, right? Because you're trying to fight the battle of the economy. And that's the trap that Ukraine's political leadership is in. And so a lot of what you're seeing are very limited volunteer efforts. The honest answer is Ukraine is not preparing for defense, at least from my point of view, nearly as seriously as it should be. And the two reasons for that are, first, the leadership trying to defend the economy and worried that there's going to be tremendous political instability if they lean forward in acknowledging the threat of invasion. But the second is the mobilization trap that they're in. If Ukraine actually pays the economic price of going through mobilization right now, they're worried that that's the pretext that Russia is looking for, that they're going to point the finger at Ukraine's leadership and say, look, they're trying to retake the Donbass, the separatist regions, and they're preparing for an attack, and then use that to justify a preemptive war, right? And that's not uncommon in history, being stuck in a mobilization trap of sorts. So, the Ukrainian leadership is just a trap between a set of bad and worse options at this stage.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about Russia's imminent invasion of Ukraine with Michael Kaufman, Director of Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analysis and a fellow at the Center for New American Security. I've seen you refer to it as the ostrich policy. Are there any decent options here for Kyiv and Zelensky?
Yeah, I'm a bit critical of it because I think that the right thing to do in a situation like this is to really, engage in statecraft, lean forward in terms of leadership, acknowledge that the threat is real, make clear what Ukraine is doing to deter possible Russian invasion and the like, and trust the public. There isn't a panic in the Ukrainian public, just to be clear. Folks don't really appreciate it. Ukrainians are very lackadaisical about this whole thing. They think they've been living under the threat of aggression this whole time. This is yet another scare of blowover. They have huge status quo bias. They think this is like any other day. It really isn't, though. And the leadership is, in denying it, is trying to, it's kind of the rookie's political attempt to manage a rapidly developing negative story. The first thing they do is deny rather than actually, lean into the narrative and try to lead it. And that's why I call it the ostrich strategy, because, the United States has made clear that the threat of invasion is severe. It's very likely to come potentially in February. And a number of other countries have said the same. And Zelensky is basically now looking like he's out there essentially saying that the earth is flat, rather than acknowledging the facts on the ground, shaping that narrative for the public, and stepping forward as a leader. That's why I'm critical, and I call it kind of more the ostrich strategy.
Michael, has Putin gone too far to pull back and not lose face? Is he at the point where he almost has to act and do something in Ukraine in order to maintain his global image?
So, I don't think he's gone too far. A leader can always back down, and leaders of great powers do back down all the time. But he definitely will suffer external and internal audience costs. There's no way that Putin can back down without paying a significant price. He has raised this to a very, very high level in terms of stakes and in course of bargaining, right? If he backs down now, a lot of people will say that not only was he bluffing, but more importantly, he was successfully deterred. He'll end up in the worst place, which is being seen as highly aggressive and resistible at the same time. And he's going to have big internal audience costs as well, not with the Russian people, but with the Russian elite. At the end of the day, Russia's a personalized authoritarian system, right? And his power very much depends on his ability to manage coalitions of elites. And he's going to take a big hit if his own elites see him as incompetent and reckless, basically launching wild gambits like this, making outrageous ultimatums and demands, and then following through on nothing. Taking a big hit in foreign policy in terms of Russian interests and preferences, and then just backing down. I've studied Russia and followed Russian leadership and the military for many, many years. I've just never known Putin to play it that way.
And Michael, we tend to focus on what Putin wants, at least here in the Western media. But what about the Russian elites. Does Putin's policy with Ukraine have the general backing of Russia's elites, or are they simply going along with Putin for the time being?
They're going to have to go along. I think some of the more hardline folks who have influence with him are definitely supportive of it. But the overall Russian elite, absolutely not. This is going to have tremendous costs and risks, and I don't think they're necessarily supportive of this gambit. Although, many are, from my impression, are kind of ambivalent about the proposition of war with Ukraine. I think their biggest concern is not losing, it's winning. They definitely don't want to see worst-case scenarios where Russia occupies Ukraine and then uses money or resources to develop it, because it would be their money and their resources, right? And they're very much after their own interests. Plus, the consequences in terms of sanctions from the United States and European countries might be pretty significant.
Do you think those Western sanctions might be enough to deter an invasion, or do you think Putin is willing to risk some sort of retribution from the West outside of direct military intervention?
Highly skeptical. Track record of sanctions and deterring states using force to pursue vital interests is awful, and consistently has failed in the past in this conflict, so I'm deeply skeptical of that. But this is going to be a great test of that, I'll tell you. There are a few times where you can see a testable proposition where one particular action is going to very clearly show you what's true and what's not. So we might find out in the coming weeks which of those stories is right.
Michael, what of the European response? It's fractured with differing levels of support, Germany in particular being singled out for providing minimal assistance compared to other European nations. It's obviously got to please Putin to see this fracturing. What do you think of Europe and its response right now and how it's handling this?
You know, it's not bad. It definitely could be better. I know it's a glib response, but so we'll talk about first the good. There's a lot of allied consensus in general on agreeing to sanctions and other costs imposed on Russia in the event of Russian aggression. Let's talk about the bad. There's disagreement amongst key states like Germany and France about what to do and what the actual assessment is of the current situation. Germany doesn't see a Russian invasion imminent. France also skeptical and thinks that there should be an alternative to European approach to negotiating with Russia rather than more of a unified one. So there are disagreements there. But I think on some important policies, they're likely to be on board. And let's talk about the ugly, which is, well, what a great showing for the European Union. The European Union is completely non-existent in this, begging desperately for a seat at the table or for some kind of relevance. So all those conversations about European strategic autonomy, when the rubber meets the road, it's very clear that without the United States, Europeans can't deter Russia. They can't lead their way out of a problem like this. And this is a very good example of where we are with Europe in 2022.
And Michael, do you see a long-term U.S. retrenchment from Europe, given everything that's going on right now? And how does that aid Putin going forward in his vision of Europe?
So the U.S. has made clear that Europe is a secondary theater now, that the primary theater is Indo-Pacific. And that's a big challenge for the United States because we have resource constraints and our strategy is much more oriented towards prioritizing the strategic contest with China, right? And Russians know that. That's part of the reason why they issued the demands. The price for stabilizing the relationship with them and trying to park it was always going to be very high, and it was going to get much higher as soon as we made clear that Europe's a secondary theater and we're trying to deleverage from that theater, right? So that being said, I do see a potential for general U.S. retrenchment, but I'm skeptical we're going to retrench that much from Europe. I think that we're going to have to balance the sort of pacing threat that China is with a persistent threat that Russia is going to be. And it's very clear that Russia gets a huge vote of where it's going to be or where it's going to fall in the U.S. agenda, like how the extent to which we're going to prioritize it. And attempts to deprioritize Russia or park the relationship so we can focus elsewhere or focus even on our domestic policy issues. Well, if we tried that, doesn't look like it's worked. So it looks like Russia's much more capable than some folks thought in setting the security agenda in Europe, and I don't expect that situation to change dramatically.
Michael, do the Baltic nations need to worry about Russia? How about Poland? How far do you think Putin is willing to go in order to implement his vision of what he thinks Europe should be?
I'm deeply skeptical on that score. I think that they've always been a threat of coercion, but not of invasion. I don't think Russia's expansionist in the sense that it wants to take the Baltic states back or, you know, repartition Poland. That said, there's going to be more demand signals from them for reassurance and for U.S. forward deployed forces and the like if there's another Russian offensive in Ukraine. That won't be surprising at all. In fact, I think the United States is prepared to exchange and force posture in Europe in response to that kind of conflict. But in terms of Russian aims, I just don't see it. This is very much about Ukraine and also about Belarus. And I can get more into that conversation, but I don't think the Baltic states themselves are as worried as they often come off about the threat of conventional invasion. I think they're much more worried about subconventional scenarios, you know, subversion, insurgency, use of special forces, information operations, use of offensive cyber capabilities, other forms of coercion, both kinetic and non-kinetic.
Russia obviously has many capabilities within its hands in order to wreak all kinds of concern and headaches across its border countries. Michael, one final thought from you. We've been seeing late February mentioned as a potential invasion date. I'm sure there's not a specific date that's out there for anybody to have their hands on. But in your best view, what would be the earliest legitimate time for Russia to make its move on Ukraine with all of its forces in place?
Yeah, this is, of course, a bit guesswork. My best guess is perhaps in the coming 2 to 3 weeks. Doesn't mean that Russia will do it, just my personal view on when I think they will be the soonest in position to be able to do it.
And we will certainly be holding our breath in the meantime, as it does seem like it is imminent. Michael, want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on The Crisis Next Door. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
We've been joined by Michael Kaufman, Director of Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analysis and a fellow at the Center for New American Security. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.